we can tend to beat ourselves up. A sense of self-criticism and a sense of, you can be driven by a sense of lack of fulfillment, trying to get and gain things, indulge in things. Try to find our security in getting and gaining, and we get a bit ashamed of ourselves and start beating ourselves up for getting and gaining. A swing which propels us most of the time, trying to get comfortable. And then feeling a bit guilty about being comfortable and beating ourselves up about it. Kama sukhari kani yogo, attakila matani yogo. That's what the Buddha called them. Linking ourselves with sense pleasures as a sense, a source of gratification, and or linking ourselves with a sense of austerity, or trying to get rid of the source of gratification. And if this was all there is, then we'd be stuck, because these are ultimately unprofitable. The first one is lowly and ignoble. Just seeking gratification through sensory delight. Seeking our sense of fulfillment through that. Sticky it is. It's ordinary, it's what ordinary, a sense of ordinary thing to do. I'll try and differentiate between ordinary and normal. Ordinary, not very ennobling. And just beating ourselves up and feeling dissatisfied and dwelling in that, it's just painful. And unprofitable. But the Buddha said there is a way that leads to a sense of peace, a sense of fulfillment, a sense of knowing, clear seeing, a sense of lack of confusion about what's happening. And this is getting into the right relationship. But it's getting into the right relationship with that which is ennobling. That which is worthy. That which is worthy, ennobling, actually true, in the sense of that which leads to peace, that which leads to clear seeing. So you have, how do you relate to these things? How do we relate to these things? What's our relationship to this? Is ennobling the first ennobling truth, the one that Buddhists get beaten over the head for and beat themselves over the head for? Dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, that which is hard to bear. It's how we relate to this that's important. It's our relationship to it that's important. We tend to think that our usual ordinary response is to try to get rid of it. Don't like to suffer, I'll get rid of it. And actually that's not ennobling. Not actually worthwhile. We move away from this dukkha. What is dukkha? The way that we need to relate to it in order to ennoble our lives and make our lives worthwhile is to know it. Know it. Rather than try to ignore it, pretend it's not there, cover it over, or just get rid of it. So when we come to talking to some of my friends, some of my bhikkhu friends, they say, I'm really interested in dukkha. All its different shapes and sizes. Start to get interested in how it manifests. What is this? Well, why is it the list of dukkhas? Birth is dukkha. Old age is dukkha. Sickness is dukkha. Death is dukkha. Grief, sorrow, lamentation and despair are hard to bear. Associating with what one doesn't want is hard to bear. Being separated from what one wants is hard to bear. Just not getting one's way is hard to bear. It's a nuisance. An understatement. And we do our, when we fail to actually know it as it actually arises, our relationship to it is not ennobling. It's not worthwhile. It's a short answer. That's why they say that patience is the supreme austerity. Being able to bear the unbearable is the way out of all of this, actually. Don't worry, it does get better. It's interest in bearing the unbearable. This whole sense of not being fooled by it. It's very interesting around kids. Birth. You know how the mind goes, oh, that's pretty. It looks at a baby. That sense of intoxicated with that sort of thing. It has to be, otherwise people wouldn't look after it. But it's his nature. But it's just one door, isn't it? Birth and death. Different doors. You know, the rest of it's pretty obvious. Getting sick isn't much fun. Old age? Do you wish it on anybody? The body starts to creak. being interested in that. That's why, you know, like stopping learning to bear with it, stay with it, being able to stay with something. Because there's something we can do. Because if it stopped there, then it would be pretty depressing. But it's useful to start there, because it's what we usually overlook. So to know dukkha is ennobling. The great thing about Buddhists is that if they believe anything, and Buddhists are pretty difficult to get them to say the creed, I believe in one Buddha, not quite, they believe that things happen because of causes. If there aren't the supporting conditions for something, then the thing itself won't arise. The causes in Buddhism are pretty sophisticated. Not just linear causes over time, but structural causes. It's like this bell is about 9 or 10 inches off the ground. If there wasn't the cushion and the platform, then it wouldn't be 9 or 10 inches off the ground. It's a structural cause. Okay, particularly if somebody doesn't put it there. It's another cause, but there are structural causes and there are different levels of causes. Many causes. Basically, if things aren't caused, then they don't happen. So dukkha, this sense of things being hard to bear, happens because it's caused. Okay? That's the, and so the response and the relationship that we have to the cause, if we want to, and if we're interested in ennobling and making our lives worthwhile, is to abandon it, let it go, put it down, relinquish it. This important little bit there, because the sense of relinquishing and letting go and putting down, I'm not saying it's easy, because we're not very practiced at that. We tend to get our sense of security and our sense of well-being out of getting and gaining, don't we? I've got everything. Actually, letting something go, putting it down, giving it up, that need to practice that. We even try and get and gain understanding. Hold that somehow firm. Like trying to work out systems and structures for it. Not even learning how to abandon those also. Clinging to ideas. So abandoning, practicing relinquishing. Come back to this, because it starts to get fun. starts to get fun. The rest, you know, this one noble truth is a bit hard, you know, it's difficult, dukkha. It's the one we need to know. The other one, abandon. We can have fun with that one. Enjoy that one, that relationship. Relating to the cause by abandoning it. Things happen because of causes. When the causes aren't there, the thing stops. That's good, isn't it? Dukkha stops. It does finish, it does end. There is the cessation of stress. There is the cessation of stress. And it really makes life worthwhile and noble when it's stopped, doesn't it? So might as well make it real. Make the cessation of dukkha real for one. That's the ennobling. That's what makes life worthwhile. That's actually what we're interested in. Realizing the cessation of dukkha. That's what I'm interested in, realizing the cessation of everything that's hard to bear. And you get people like Lumpo Samedo sitting up here and chuckling and saying, there is no dukkha. Because when the cessation has been made real, because that's an actually a reality. Dukkha is to be known. The thing about to be known, because the thing why it needs to be known is because actually, on one level, all dukkha is not actually true. It's a bit of a show. But we take it to be real. We make dukkha real, keep causing, making causes for dukkha. Ignore the cessation. Pretend it isn't, doesn't exist. We get our relationships. Our relationships are mucked up, you know. And then the fourth ennobling truth, get our relationship right to that one. Fourth noble truth. There is a way to the cessation of dukkha. There is a way. And our responsibility, there is a method, there is a path, there is a practice, there's something we can do. A noble relationship to that, a worthwhile relationship to that, is to get on your bike and do it. To do it. Practice it. Practice the Eightfold Path. That's what makes life worthwhile. Because it is possible to practice. It is possible to develop. Actually, the only thing worthwhile, really. If we're really interested in a true life, a real life, because nobody said that dukkha in itself was an absolute reality. It's just pointing out a way of relating to what we experience, which is actually at one level, false. There's no absolute birth and death, separation from the like, association with the dislike, grief, sorrow, lamentation, and despair. But we better know it, because if we don't know it, then we get fooled by it. We get fooled by it. We start thinking that we are these bodies. We have these experiences. There is something absolute behind it all. Causes and conditions. To know dukkha, to abandon the cause, to to realize the cessation and to practice the path. And the path? The path begins with getting a clear perspective on it. Sammāditti. Right view, it's sometimes translated as perfect perspective, balanced view. A balanced view. A view that actually, this is the strangeness of it, because on a transcendent level, right view is actually realizing the Four Noble Truths. How do you do that? You have to start. Actually, to the degree to which dukkha is known is the degree to which the path is practiced, is the degree to which the causes of dukkha are abandoned, the degree to which the cessation of dukkha is realized. It's the little ratchet in there. Because the other great thing that Buddhists take as a view at an ordinary level, one takes Sammāditti on a mundane level, it's an interesting thing. On an ordinary level, what is, as called a mundane level, given that we're ordinary people. You see, normal people, in my scheme of things, and I don't claim to be normal at all, are completely enlightened. All the rest of us are ordinary and slightly potty. We're not actually seeing things straight. It's my standard of what's normal, enlightenment. I'm going for it. Not just coping, but complete enlightenment. That's normal. It's actually in accordance with truth, seeing things actually as they are. The rest of us, one of the aspects of mundane right view is to believe that that's possible. If you don't believe it's possible to be completely free from confusion, completely free from need and greed, hatred, you don't believe that's possible, you're not going to try, are you? You may not know if it's possible. I'm not asking you to have complete knowing, but at least have the perspective and the opinion and come from the starting point. It is possible to be act in ways that are completely free from confusion, completely free from greed and fear, completely free from aversion. Actually, if you notice enough, you do it quite a lot of the time. But most of us overlook it because it's quite peaceful. And we get caught in excitement, wanting excitement, wanting stimulation. So part of mundane right view is that it is possible. The next part of mundane right view is there is the results of actions. Intentional actions have results. They're not incredibly interesting, actually. Tell as many times as you like. It's practicing. There, your practice right view is really, really, really helps. Right intention, good. Right speech, perfect speech, sammā vācā. Speech that's kindly to the point, in accordance with truth, not harsh, not gossipy. Who's the person you most talk to? maybe not out loud. I talk to myself most. What sort of conversations do you have with yourself? Are they samavaja? This is actually probably stretching it a bit, because there is really about actually what comes out of the mouth. But it's interesting to consider internally and talk to ourselves what sort of conversations we have about ourselves, to ourselves, or about other people. And how much are they actually practicing leading towards peace? That's interesting, you can know. I don't know. Not into reading minds. It's an interesting one. Sammakamanto, right action. Somebody can practice relinquishment. Kindness in action is actually bodily action, not action that's not harmful. So you're taking time for that. Practicing generosity, the actual act of giving something. It's an act of relinquishment. You're going to practice the right relationship to the cause of suffering. Practice relinquishment. You want to get rid of the causes of suffering in your life. Practice relinquishment. And that's why generosity is such a lovely beginning. Because it could be done at every level. Getting used to the idea that I've got enough. Because I can't be generous unless I feel I've got enough. And what I want to feel is fulfilled. I'd like to feel I've got enough. But I've got to practice doing it. Rather than thinking, well, I haven't got enough to give. And so if one even just gives a little bit, I've got enough to give a little bit. And one's already practiced a little bit of relinquishment. Getting used to the idea that one's got enough. Just, and then keep doing it. That's why it's so beautiful in Thailand and places where they offer a little bit of rice every day. And the little grandmothers take their kids and they offer a little bit of rice. Keep doing it. If you relinquish a lot of the causes of suffering in your life, you'll gain an incredible amount. You realize an incredible amount of the cessation of dukkha. It's a strange one, because the one looks at the traditional stories of the lives of the Buddha. You've got this, the last life of the Buddha, as a bodhisattva before he got born in the Tusita heavens. Full birth as a human being. There's this incredible story of generosity which makes us Westerners just weep. Because in the Visantara Jataka, those of you who know it, this prince born into an incredibly wealthy position decides that he's just going to give everything away. Whatever anything anybody asks of him, he'll give it away. Why does he give things away? gives all the wealth, all his wealth away to anybody who asks for him. He gives the kingdom's white elephant away. So the subjects feel that he's given the luck of the kingdom away. So they throw him out of the kingdom with his wife and children. Guess what he gives away? His wife and kids to a horrible person who treats them terribly. Does come right in the end. Does come right in the end. It's all just God testing him. But just that, you know, we can feel our sort of sense of, you've got to be careful about what you give to, who you give to. You know, going, you can't do that. It's interesting. Generosity is always beneficial. Even giving to insects is beneficial. Giving particularly without any thought of anything in return. Not bargaining. Just practicing giving. That's why I think the little bit of rice that people give is good. They can't be expecting anything back, really. Little kids, just practicing giving. Right livelihood. Right livelihood. Appropriate livelihood. Easier, I suppose. Some ways more difficult in others, depending on how subtle one practices it. Not dealing in slavery, dealing in human beings, probably not most of us here. Interesting, because it's just a series of knots at this point. There's no actual prescription of what right livelihood is. It's just a prescription of what wrong livelihood is. Wrong livelihoods, dealing in weapons, alcohols, animals, poisons, and humans. Poisons includes drugs. Starts to get more complicated when one recognizes, you know, one's relationship to money. And that energy. And again, we're talking about relationships, maybe you want to consider. With Buddhism, or with a way of interpreting Buddhism that I tend to use, you don't know something, you don't really know something until you know its origin, where it comes from, its properties, that's its characteristics. The danger of it, the benefit that one can get from it, and how to relate to it so one gains the benefit and doesn't get caught in the danger. And if one doesn't really know something unless one has that breadth of knowledge, where it comes from, its characteristics, the danger associated with it, the benefit, and how to relate to it so one gets the benefit and doesn't get caught in the danger. And all sorts of things one can consider. And it's humbling how little one knows. How to money, where it comes from, its characteristics, the danger of it, the benefit of it, how one can relate to it so one gains the benefit and doesn't get caught in the danger. Clothing. Cars. Shelter. Telephones. Computers. Books. Marriage. Kids. Even emotions go through. I was wondering, you know, where's the place of fear? How does that work? What's the benefit, the danger of it? How do I relate to fear so I gain the benefit and don't get caught in the danger? What's it worth being frightened about? It's actually useful. What's it not worth being frightened about? It has a function, comes from somewhere. And livelihood with that, like money particularly, you know, considering how one relates to that, so that there's as least involvement as possible in that which is wrong livelihood. Least support can be possible from that which is wrong livelihood. Dealing in weapons, dealing in alcohol, dealing in animals, dealing in humans, dealing in poisons. And that's where I get going on. And just considering what you spend your money on. How much support you give to those wrong livelihoods. Support people in wrong livelihood and maybe don't even know that they're in wrong livelihood. Such is the nature of ignorance. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. Right effort. Practicing right effort. Four ways of right effort. Consider. First of all, to notice that which is not so skillful in what one does, what I do. And to practice stopping it. Just stopping that which is unskillful. First thing. To maintain that which one notices is skillful, keep that going. So to have some discrimination, some judgment there. And then looking a bit further, noticing that which is unskillful that one hasn't started to do, and not doing it. So, not picking up habits which ain't so helpful. And then noticing in other people, things that are skillful, and picking it up. Because we're talking about a refuge is what? The first refuge I talked about is wisdom. The Buddha, the one who knows, the one who thinks clearly. are translated as wisdom. That's what we bow to, that's where we seek security. And if we're really, really stupid, we never ever notice or admit that we've ever ever made any mistakes. It's the nature of stupidity, the nature of ignorance, is that it doesn't know. It doesn't know even when something's wrong. The nature of ignorance, that's the nature. That's why it's very difficult with animals, because they don't, you know, they just don't know. And humans also. So one of the first things the Buddha said was that to admit that one's made a mistake always leads to growth in the Buddha's dispensation. If one honestly admits a mistake, that wasn't right. That wasn't in accordance with the truth. What I thought then, what I said then, what I did then, was not actually practicing the path. That always, always leads to growth, actually being willing to admit it. If we're a bit clever, we learn from our mistakes. Cleverer still, we learn from other people's mistakes. That's what education's about, isn't it? Noticing that, oh, that's the way they went, and that wasn't so hot. Go down this way. That's what learning is about. Education is about learning from other people's mistakes. It's possible, part of right effort. And developing a continuity with that, particularly around the meditation, particularly this right effort, right concentration, with right mindfulness, sammāsati. Mindfulness that actually sees the context in which things are happening. Actually is appropriate as sampajanya, clear comprehension of what's happening. That's something to be exercised. That interest in what the heck's happening here. Happening internally, what's happening externally, how's it going, and what's being, that's why the whole, every single skillful state has an element of sammāsati in it, like mindfulness. I know what I'm doing, why I'm doing it, and the context in which it's happening. So why do we do all this? Sitting, walking. So why we take things like precepts. Like these five precepts, because it's like saying, hey, you come close to breaking those, if one's broken those, if one's actually decided to keep them, one's got a way of noticing. Hey, oh, I'm just about to kill this. Uh-huh. Am I taking something here? Am I stealing something here? Is this really given? How am I related to this sexual energy? What's my speech up to? Am I lying? Am I clear about what's happening? And then you can extend these precepts, so you wind up with the 227 or more the bhikkhus use, which was supposed to give them a way of relating to that. Also, with precepts, you can pick them up wrongly. You can pick up the five precepts wrongly. You know, you practice an incorrect relationship to them. They come from somewhere, they have certain characteristics. There are certain benefits that can be got from them. There are certain dangers. How do I relate to the five precepts so I gain the benefit and don't get caught in the danger? When I first heard of the five precepts, I didn't relate to them very well at all. I never took them. Because I've never taken the five precepts, actually. Because I thought if I took them, I'd have to keep them forever and ever, amen. Some sort of promise that I was making. So the first precepts I took were actually the eight precepts. Because I recognized I'd never be able to keep those. So I'd have to work with that. So I recognized that there was something that you practiced. I didn't realize when I first heard of the five precepts that there was something you practiced. You actually have the opportunity to admit you broke them and start again. You can also relate to precepts in a way that makes you all sort of puffed up. I'm pure. And that's a pain. That's a pain. Pain for you, pain for other people. Did you know you broke the precept? Use them as a weapon. Get them, use them as a weapon. This is a knife you can use for chopping vegetables or something to stab somebody with. Use the precepts as a weapon. You can beat yourself up with them. They're supposed to make life easy. They're supposed to do. They're supposed to lead to the realization of the cessation of suffering. That's what I'm interested in. Bear this in mind. It is clear. Realize the cessation of suffering. Abandon the causes. No dukkha. Get it right. We're talking about relationships here. How we're relating to all of this. Appropriate relationship. When you're sitting meditation, the moment when you're actually sitting meditation, you've got the view that you can get enlightened, developing insight into dukkha, you're knowing dukkha, yes, it's painful, it's a bit stiff. Okay. You're abandoning the causes of dukkha, you're not trying to move on. Got in time, realizing the cessation of dukkha, practicing the path. You've actually got all the path together when you sit. You're not speaking too much. You're not talking to yourself too much. You can get that together. You've got the opportunity each sitting to practice the Eightfold Path, all of it. Don't pick up all these talks and think, well, I have to remember it all. So actually, that's one of the ways they do say that you can keep awake, is to run through an aspect of Dhamma. Remember the 12 links of dependent origination, the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. At least it gives you something to do. Keeps you awake. So bit of a diversion this evening. I'll stop there this evening. Won't open it to questions yet because it could get quite sort of bitty. But offer it for contemplation. Don't expect that all of it's completely true. But do at least consider, and if anything's useful, then the best thing is to use it. If it isn't useful, leave it here. Don't need to carry it away with you. Abandon it. Realize the cessation of dukkha. Wishing you very well.